Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of power belongs to a storyteller who dares to mix fictional characters with real-world people and events? Author James Ellroy's latest offering begins in Los Angeles hours before the 1941 Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and tumbles out almost in real time over 23 days, leading readers into every corner of a city that served as a kind of sordid playground for criminals, corrupt cops, and spoiled celebrities. The new book is called Perfidia, and it is the first title in a series that will function as a prequel to Ellroy's celebrated L.A. Quartet, which included The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere, L.A. Confidential, and White Jazz. James Ellroy is in town for a signing and reading event tonight at the Angelica Film Center in Mockingbird Station, followed by a screening of the film adaptation of L.A. Confidential, hosted by movie critic Chris Wagner. James Ellroy, welcome to Think.
Chris, I am nothing but happy to be here.
Good.
In Big D.
In Big D. Well, you're from Big L.A. originally,
yeah.
And lots of people grow up in a place and they love it or they hate it, they have memories, but it's not such a huge part of their consciousness. What is it about Los Angeles that has formed you to such a degree?
A pundit 40 years ago uttered these words, L.A., come on vacation, go home on probation. I was lucky enough to have been hatched in L.A., the film noir epicenter at the height of the film noir era. It owns me. My mother was murdered there when I was 10 years old, and it's where I go when women divorce me. L.A., it's a life sentence.
Your mother's case is still unsolved.
It's still unsolved. I wrote a book about it, my 1997 memoir, My Dark Places. It sparked my astounding curiosity into LA's social past. And that curiosity has mutated over half a century now.
Do you feel more connected to an LA that you can't even personally remember than to the LA that exists right now?
Not only that, I am most bodily connected, most morally and spiritually connected to the L.A. before my birth, hence my novel, Perfidia.
Mm-hmm. There is something about the years that immediately precede when we're born that seem very interesting to a lot of people. What do you think that's about?
It is us grasping at racial consciousness. In 1956, when I was 8 years old, I said something that alerted my mother to the fact that I passionately believed that World War II was still going on. It pervaded the consciousness of that era just that much. My mother told me, au contraire, Sonny, you were born 3 years after the war ended. And to this day, I'm not sure that I believe her.
What does it take to get the cadence of language of the period into your head to an extent that you can write dialogue that absolutely feels real?
Threadbare knowledge of the era itself, a great deal of imagination, and a heedless willingness to violate the strictures of political correctness.
Some of it is difficult to read with a modern sensibility. I guess it's a reminder of how open people were. I mean, you are writing about characters who've not even been exposed to the idea that you should be respectful of other cultures and other experiences.
Yes, and here's the crux of that and why my lack of political correctness specifically offends some critics, not many readers. With me, racial invective and casually expressed racial animus is just that. It's a casual attribute. PCers want their racial invective and racial animus to serve as a defining characteristic. You have characters who are admirable in many regards, yet they utter these words. And some readers and most critics don't know how to take it.
So the idea is they feel that if the words didn't exist, the sentiments wouldn't exist, and most people can understand that that's not the case.
No, it's not the case, and the whole concept of racism levels the entire construction of racism to a fatuous degree, where if you utter a racial epithet, you're the same as the men who lynched Emmett Till in 1955, Mississippi, for whistling at a white woman, and it simply isn't the case.
So do you always imagine an entire biography for your characters? You take us back in time to, in some ways, revisit characters that we've met in your other novels.
Perfidia is the first volume of the second L.A. Quartet. It takes real-life and fictional characters from my first two extended body of historical novels, the L.A. Quartet, the Black Dahlia, the Big Nowhere, L.A. Confidential, and White Jazz. As you mentioned, that's post-war L.A. And then my big political novels set between 58 and 72, American Tabloid, The Cold 6000, Blood's a Rubber, places them in L.A., during World War II, as significantly younger people. I know the main characters backwards and forwards. What I had to do in plotting out Perfidia was reread my own previous seven novels and compile fact sheets and chronologies to get physical appearances, dates of birth, ranks on the police department entirely correct.
What is that experience like for you? I mean, obviously you're going into the story, but it's also got to take you back to the work process of creating those novels.
I love history. I live history. History to me, more than anything else, and I hope we can discuss it, is a state of yearning. It's yearning for history itself. It's yearning for the women of a given slice of history. I suffer from and benefit from benign megalomania. I love to create big things. My creative model isn't even a writer. It's Beethoven. I discovered him as a kid 50 years ago. If a kid with artistic dreams wants to identify with an artist, go right to the top, the greatest artist of all time, Beethoven. I like to be alone in a room. I'm computer illiterate. I've never used a computer. I don't have a cell phone. I write these big books by hand. I think history. I live history. I brood history. I'm obsessed with history. And it pips, pops, percolates within me. I love the language of history. I love the American idiom. I love racial invective. I love Yiddish. I love black hepcat hipster jazz patois. I love alliteration. Your first name starts with a K instead of a C. That delighted me when I saw the billboard in
you.
Front of this radio station.
Do you write as easily as you just laid out that very interesting string of ideas?
Yes. But I constantly go back and refine the language. I'm a fine public speaker. I am nothing but the sign of Protestant clergy. I am to the pulpit born. I love to give speeches. I emcee police events. And I love to write. I love the American idiom.
How did you discover that you loved to write? And that you really had, how did you find your way to what has become your genre?
I read a boatload of crime novels as a kid, and I started in the wake of my mother's death. The crime novels that I read, first kid books and then graduating to adult books, gave me a sublimated dialogue on my mother's death, as well as a tidy resolution, a resolution that did not occur for me in real life. From that point, I was hooked on storytelling, on narrative, on history, on crime. I've been to at least 13 trillion cop and mystery private eye movies. I've watched an equal number of TV shows, but primarily growing up and as a young adult, I just read that kind of book, and that kind of book almost exclusively.
If the story that is told about you is true, your father actually gave you a book to read after your mother died.
It did. My dad gave me Jack Webb's book, The Badge, which was an ode to the Los Angeles Police Department, and it contained a haunting 10-page summary of the Black Dahlia murder case, the young woman hideously tortured named Elizabeth Short, and it's the most famous unsolved homicide case in American history. And I wrote the novel later, The Black Dahlia, which is the first book in the L.A. Quartet. Elizabeth Short, by the way, appears in this book.
As a teenager.
As a teenager. Heartbreakingly alive. I wanted to honor her by portraying her vibrantly alive.
Yeah, it was hard knowing what's coming for her. Even though, reading the novel, you wouldn't necessarily know what's ahead unless you've already read the other works. But do you have to put that out of your mind as you're writing her deeply alive in the moment?
I feel every single human being as I write their dialogue or write from their perspective. A noted writer, it might have been Ruth Rendell, said that she's possessed of a promiscuous empathy. I'm quite the rigorous moralist, but I have that degree of empathy as well.
My guest is novelist James Elroy. His newest book is called Perfidia. He's in town for a signing, screening, and reading event tonight at the Angelica Film Center in Mockingbird Station. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. We'll resume our conversation with James Elroy in just a moment.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with novelist James Elroy about his new book, Perfidia. He's in town for a screening, signing, and reading event tonight at the Angelica Film Center in Mockingbird Station. The whole thing starts at 6:30. It will be a signing, then a reading, followed by a screening of a film adaptation of L.A. Confidential. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. James, for people who have not taken an SAT prep course in a while, the word perfidy, of course, is means betrayal. Where did the title Perfidia come from?
There's a marvelous Latin-tinged big band song circa 1938 called Perfidia. It's been covered vocally in Spanish and English a million times, and there are haunting instrumental versions as well. And now my heart cries out, Perfidia. This is the story, Perfidia, my novel, of the party at the edge of the abyss and the precipice of America's ascendance. There's four big party scenes in there. Being a person alive in Los Angeles under imminent threat of Japanese sea and air attacks in the month of December 1941 wasn't all bad. There were fabulous love affairs, great fist fights. There was a marvelous murder case. It was a time of righteous patriotic fervor coexisting a heartbeat away from vile racial animus. It was just a gassy time to live in L.A. The clothes were great. The booze flowed freely. The cars. Man, there were some good-looking cars then.
Pearl Harbor, the attack on Pearl Harbor is a very interesting hook, I think, for this. And you were saying before that you really do live in the past. We were talking in the break. You're not trying to connect this to maybe contemporary memories that people have of something like the 9/11 attacks.
No. Perfidia came from my intense immersion. Now, I go to the store. I walk outside. I don't exist in this cold, dark room all the time. But I'm computer illiterate. I don't have a cell phone. I don't have a television set. I don't listen to the radio. I have a stereo system and a bunch of classical CDs. I go to the store. I have a car. I have a girlfriend. I have a life. That stated, it's a very internal world that I live in. I poke my head out every once in a while and get a gander on the weather and then go back to it. And I'm not joking. I'm not being disingenuous here. I live it. And the result is there on the page. And I have this ability to assume diverse perspectives. And Perfidia showcases my greatest diversity of character and motive. I write in a woman's diary format.
Let me stop you there, because the Diary of Kay Lake is really a fascinating element of this. How do you, is it easy to just think, okay, right now, I'm for the next 3 hours of writing, I'm a woman?
Yes. Kay Lake is 21 years old. She's a self-described dilettante. And oddly and powerfully and almost supernaturally, she is everything that she tells you she is at her very first diary entry. Kay Lake, in my earlier written Ladder Set book, serves as the feminine lead of the Black Dahlia. She will go on to marry the man in the Black Dahlia that she's fixated on in the early pages of Perfidia. I got around this seamlessly, thematically and technically, because we're never in Kay Lake's perspective in the Black Dahlia. Now we have full access to her thoughts. My severest critic and my greatest critic is my brilliant ex-wife, second ex-wife, best friend, the novelist Helen Knode. And she thinks Kay Lake is my most stunning and brilliant fictional creation. And I have to agree. I was very much in love with her while I wrote her. So one can say, since she doesn't exist outside my mind, that this is an onanistic and narcissistic love, but I don't care. She embodies the heroism of the World War II American woman.
It's remarkable to think about, you know, we're always told to beware of unreliable narrators. And you as novelist are telling us she's not an unreliable narrator.
She is and she isn't. She's wrong about people quite often. And she has to recant her previously written assertions. She's 21. She does not know, in many ways, you know what, from Shinola.
Right.
But she does recant and she does grow up and she does cleave to a through line of moral and spiritual growth in this book.
She's in a really interesting relationship here, too, a non-sexual relationship with someone that she lives with as if she's cohabitating with him, but they're not having sex.
No. And tragically, from her viewpoint, tragically from LAPD officer Lee Blanchard's viewpoint as well, and cohabiting way back in 1941 was some shocking stuff and would get you fired from the LAPD in a heartbeat. She's nothing if not paradoxical. Ambiguous doesn't describe her. Ambiguity describes passivity, or implies it at least. She's all paradox. She has the intellectual rigor. She can play the piano very, very well. She's obsessed with two of my heroes, Beethoven and Luther. She can sketch. She's up for anything. And she's very much a romantic figure that has sprung from my thousands of hours of brooding in the dark and listening to classical music.
You describe her, though, as not conventionally attractive.
She's mid-range tall. She's auburn-haired. She has a bump on her nose. She's madcap. She wears saddle shoes, which I've always liked on women. I think saddle shoes are a gas. She has some groovy tweed suits. William H. Parker, in many ways the moral voice, however conflicted, of this book, is fixated on her in troubling ways and entraps her for a dubious political pogrom of his and keeps buying her clothes.
So your Parker is a fictionalized version of someone who was very much a real figure, ran the LAPD as chief for 16 years, from 1950 to 1966 when he died. Tell us about him and how much is drawn from the historical record and how much is drawn from your imagination.
in the end, I want the historical record there so I can create a seamless verisimilitude. I want the latitude to fictionalize within the confines of established facts. Kay Lake, we know from The Black Dahlia, is from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. She's a Midwestern girl, migrated to L.A., and went more than a little bit wrong. William H. Parker was, in reality, born in Deadwood, South Dakota. He had, throughout his lifetime, a horrible battle with booze. It was something that took down his Union Army Colonel, U.S. Congressman, granddad at age 61. He was equal parts reactionary and progressive. He was a man of sobbing, overweening intelligence and brutal, brutal emotion. A pious Roman Catholic, atypically from Deadwood, South Dakota, who winds up ascending and doing things that he wished he hadn't done under the reign of a certain corrupt police chief who's in this book, in order to secure his reforming slot on LAPD. He is nothing if not titanically paradoxical and cut down the middle. And as we know from having read novels throughout our individual lifetime, this is the stuff that makes for great drama. The 39-year-old William H. Parker, unhappily married. The 21-year-old Kay Lake, looking for adventure. Something's got to give.
And Parker is well aware of his own weaknesses. He's not someone who is sort of in, maybe he's in denial, but he knows he has a drinking problem at least.
He does. He's always taken the pledge. He's always gone to church. He's always praying.
He's always failing.
He's always failing. He's always succeeding. He's always doing something stupid and brave that belies his essential ambitiousness and a core timidity that he is in constant battle with.
If you had a time machine, would you actually want to hang out with these characters that you've created?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm a sports car guy. And if there were a dial on some groovy modern sports car, contemporary sports car, that would allow me to go December 6th, 1941, like you turn on the air conditioning, I'd go back in a heartbeat.
My guest is novelist James Elroy. His new book is called Perfidia. He's in town for a signing, screening, and reading event tonight at the Angelica Film Center in Mockingbird Station. It starts at 6:30 and will conclude with a screening hosted by Dallas Morning News movie critic Chris Wagner of the film L.A. Confidential, which, of course, is part of the original L.A. Quartet by James Elroy. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
Sad lament, my dreams have faded like a broken melody.
While the gods of love look down and laugh at what romantic fools we mortals be.
That is the song Perfidia, which inspired the title of my guest's latest novel. James Elroy is with us, and Perfidia is the name of the new book. He's in town for a screening, signing, and reading event tonight at the Angelica Film Center at Mockingbird Station. It's hard to listen to that and not fall in love with it. It's a great song.
It's a fabulous song. I first heard it as a 13-year-old nose picker in junior high school, and it was a surf guitar version of it, and it led me to the song we just heard. And I think I was 40 years old when I realized sooner or later I got to write a novel with that title, and here it is.
But you write in longhand. Was there a time that you thought I should try this? Everybody else has made the conversion. Is there something about the physical process of holding a pen in your hand and scratching it along the paper that seems to influence the way you work?
Throughout my life, I've known six or seven things and been interested in six or seven things. But I know them all. And if I know something, I'm generally right. I've shied away from computers on instinct. I'm anxious enough without checking cell phones every 5 seconds. I live in Los Angeles. I've almost been plowed dead in cars half a dozen times by younger people who are not obeying traffic laws and are looking into their laps, where I am assuming they're sending a text message or an email or looking at the latest communique.
Let's hope that's what they're looking at.
Yes, yes. And so I've given it the go by, and it served me well.
I wonder if that's why you're able to be so prolific, because you're not distracted by this stuff that causes even very productive people to waste hours every day.
What I can do very, very well is sustain concentration. I know how the title of your program here, Think. I know how to do that. I know how to sit in a room and think. I know how to start with a bunch of ideas. Japanese family killed in the hours before Pearl Harbor in Los Angeles. Patriotic fervor, racial animus, closeted homosexual Japanese American forensic chemist in the deepest of peril, conflicted Whiskey Bill Parker, the demonic Irish cop Dudley Smith, Kay Lake herself. This, J. Edgar Hoover, some other, Fiorella LaGuardia, who had a walk-on from Eleanor Roosevelt. I can think, and I can follow it through, and I can embellish at light speed, and again, the title of your program, because I know how to think, because I know how to be alone and sustain concentration.
Hideo Ishida, the police chemist that you talked about, who is a closeted gay, is another character that really drew me in, because he is sort of struggling with who he is in a time when it was simply by definition something that he could not reveal to anyone.
The portrayal, my portrayal of Hideo Ishida is, I think, quite delicate. He has fantasies. He's a brilliant young man, and he's concocted a camera device that has allowed him to sate his sexual curiosity as well as his criminal curiosity. So the instrument of his voyeurism is also put to work as an instrument of police work. And in fact, the ultimate solution of the Watanabe murder case derives from this Buck Rogers-like device that Ishida has created. And I very much enjoyed writing from his perspective. And it was difficult because he is not volatile. He is in no way verbose. He is entirely measured, circumspect, devious, and intelligent beyond words. Kay Lake may be equally intelligent, William H. Parker certainly, but they're always shooting their traps off. And it was tough to create the buttoned-up Ishida.
Let's talk about one of the ultimate villains in fiction written in the 20th and 21st century. Dud Smith is so complicated, because he's a terrible person. At the time that we meet him here, he's a sergeant in the police department. He kills people, he schemes and plots, and yet he has this sort of paternalistic attitude toward women who have been victims of crimes.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, you dug him, right? Did you dig him?
I hated the fact that I did, yes. All I was
right.
Very interested in him.
Yeah. He's charming. Even Kay Lake at some point, coming fully to grips with the extent of Dudley Smith's evil, says that she can't hate him and acknowledge his, and this is a quote, incredibly democratic cultivation of family, his sincere appreciation of Hideo Ishida. He has a felonious lesbian doctor chum who works at a movie studio and is quite enamored of her. And he's an Irishman in his Blarney packed way. He does horrible things. But if you don't mess with Dudley Smith, Dudley Smith's agenda, or women in general, he will treat you just great, buy you a corned beef sandwich, or better yet, take you over to the basement and the basement opium den at Kwan's Chinese Pagoda, where there's always a tile game going on and there's great chop suey served 24/7.
Why are we as readers so susceptible to the charms of reprehensible rogues?
Because they exist beyond conscience. Because what they have more than anything else is a psychopathic bonhomie that leads them to take great risks, suffer dire consequences, and because they possess a boldness that we do not. There's Dudley Smith, in the course of Perfidia's 700 pages, has a passionate affair with a notable movie star of the day.
That must have been fun to write.
It was a gas. It was nothing but a blast. And it was factually and historically valid because the sexual playing field, the romantic playing field, the social playing field was leveled the month of December 1941 because we, Angelenos, for differing reasons, were all terrified and were all united by common cause. So someone, and I won't be coy about this, the woman's Betty Davis. Well, it's entirely consistent that she might be willing to deign, given her own appetites, to mess around with someone like the tall, handsome, charming Irishman Dudley Smith.
And the idea is it makes her feel very real and very much of the people when she hangs out with him?
She was reprehensible and, in fact, monstrous in many ways and about as deep as a tortilla outside of her art. And yes, she was good to common people because in very small increments, they made her feel real.
Does it ever occur to you that some kid who's 10 years old right now might grow up longing for the year that you and I are sitting in right now?
Yes. And I have some advice for them. Put down that cell phone. Put down that nihilistic video game. Don't go to that dystopian movie where the world blows up at the end or almost blows up at the end. Avoid teenage sex comedies that glorify bad behavior and drug use. Sit down and force yourself to read a book. Doesn't have to be my book. I had a great deal of fun as a 13, 14-year-old reading some racy adult novels that aren't at all racy by today's standards. The works of the undervalued American writers like Irving Wallace and Harold Robbins. They sold a lot of books, and I know why. They told a damn good story. There was an outrageous milieu and plenty of sex, and it appealed to 13-year-old kids like yours truly.
James Elroy's new novel is called Perfidia. He's in town for a signing, screening, and reading event tonight at 6:30 at the Angelica Film Center in Mockingbird Station. James, it's been such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
It was a marvelous pleasure, Chris. Thank you.